Today is Monday, April 24th. It's our last day of content. We cover the ear and any questions for the final exam today. Okay, so we're taking a look at the ear information. We're still talking about special senses. In your course pack, this is page 130. You know, in terms of special senses, we have beyond the eye and the ear, taste and smell and equilibrium. The ear is actually responsible for two senses, not just hearing, but also equilibrium. So that means the only two senses we don't really cover in here in detail are the sense of taste and the sense of smell. So in terms of the ear, the external anatomy is devoted strictly to collecting sound waves. And so the external ear has a large outer portion that we call the pinna or the auricle. And the whole purpose there is to channel the sound waves down your ear opening or ear canal. The ear canal that collects those sound waves is called what? Yeah, good. Auditory meatus. So it's an external auditory meatus. It is sometimes called your auditory canal, but it is that canal that channels sound waves down to the deeper portions of your ear. So inside that external auditory meatus, there's little tiny hairs and earwax. The job there, of course, is to trap any kind of incoming debris from making its way further into your ear. That earwax is supposed to move out naturally on its own accord. You know, we've all heard about don't stick anything in your ear except for your elbow, because anything that you put in your ear can technically pack the earwax deeper. And earwax can harden like a rock, and it can actually cause a certain type of deafness if it's done over a period of years. So that earwax is supposed to be exported to the outside of your ear canal. Once we reach the eardrum, we have finished with the external ear. That eardrum is called the tympanic membrane. So that membrane is the first structure to vibrate with sound waves when sound is traveling into your ear. Okay, so eardrum is tympanic membrane. It's the first structure to vibrate with sound waves. So the sound waves that vibrate against your tympanic membrane are then sent through a series of three teeny tiny bones. These are called the ossicles, and they are ear bones, and it is their job to amplify or make louder the sounds coming into your ear. Okay, so we're going to do them in order as the sound waves progress through. The first one to vibrate with sound waves is called the malleus. In plain English, what is the malleus known as? Hammer. Yep, it's the hammer. So it's the first bone to vibrate. The next one to vibrate is the incus, otherwise known as the anvil. You'll notice the incus is then connected to the stirrup or stapes or stapes. I've heard it pronounced many different ways, but stirrup, its more professional name you might say is stapes or stapes. So interesting little tiny bones here. It is their job to vibrate to increase the noise or the sounds that we hear. So it is their job to amplify sound waves. That's a really important job for them to do, because if you don't let your ossicle bones vibrate, then the sounds that you hear are not quite loud enough to interpret. So people who can't hear properly may in fact have ear bones or ossicles that are fused together. We'll talk about what kind of deafness that is in just a few moments. But, you know, if you have ringing in your ears or a constant humming or buzzing in your ears, it could be one of those little ear bones is constantly vibrating. And when it vibrates, it generates noise that goes back into your brain. So tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears, could in fact be a problem with those bones actively generating noise by themselves in a completely quiet space that gives you a sense of humming or buzzing. So the stapes or stapes actually sits against a little tiny opening here into the inner ear, and that little tiny opening is called an oval window. If you look at the base of the stapes or stapes, it does look like it has an oval-shaped base, and so it does fit against an oval window. And so that's the opening into the inner ear space. There is actually another window here. This one down here is called the round window. So this middle ear location is supposed to be an air-filled area of your ear. Unfortunately, if you're a kid, your eustachian tubes or auditory tubes here that connect your ear to your throat may not lay at an angle. They may lay more horizontal. That makes it really easy for things like mucus and bacteria to travel back into the middle ear and cause an ear infection. We call that otitis media when it's an honest-to-goodness bacterial infection. Of course, the older you get, the more those tubes sit at an angle, and it's less likely for an infection to climb its way back up into this middle ear area. A lot of times, if you have pressure on your ears, it's just that. It may be mucus that's built up in the middle ear area. Maybe you've got a cold or a sinus infection. So in that case, it may simply be pressure that's worked its way here and is pushing on the back side of that eardrum. So if we can relieve the pressure, whether it's through decongestants or blowing our nose, that may help to alleviate some of that mucus that's built up in that normally air-filled space. All right, so how about questions about outer ear or middle ear? All right, so let's talk about the inner ear. I think in the previous picture, you might get a sense of this. It's in blue on this picture. And this inner ear area is in fact a fluid-filled space, not an air-filled space like we see in the middle ear cavity. So the inner ear has a type of fluid that sloshes around in there when you move your head. And it's also important for the transmission of sound waves into the brain. So here we finally encounter a set of fluids in our ear, in this inner ear space. So you'll notice on your sheet something called a bony labyrinth and a membranous labyrinth. These are just cavities inside of that inner ear, and these cavities contain a fluid. And you'll notice the fluid comes in either two forms, a perilymph or an endolymph. Okay, so those fluids are actually found inside the inner ear, either in the bony area or in the membranous area. So let's talk about the sound organ, which is called the cochlea. The cochlea is the organ of hearing within the inner ear. And I think it looks like a little snail or a cinnamon bun or something that's all twisted up, and it's right here, okay? So this structure is our cochlea, and its job is to get those sound waves that have been transmitted to it and then send those sound waves on into the brain by way of this vestibulocochlear nerve. Do you remember which cranial nerve that is? Going to touch and feel. Yeah, very green. There you go. So number 8 is vestibulocochlear nerve, and that one transmits sound waves and equilibrium information into your brain. So the cochlea inside has a rather interesting structure. Let me take you inside. Inside the cochlea, there are little sound detectors, you might say, called hair cells. And these hair cells sit on top of a membrane called a basilar membrane. These basilar membranes sit on an organ called the organ of Corti. Okay, and so when you cut through this thing, it looks kind of like a pine cone in a way, or kind of looks like a cut through a snail. You get the sense that there's a lot of spaces inside the cochlea, and sitting on each one of these membranes is a little set of hair cells. So when fluids travel past those hair cells, if the fluid movement is strong enough, then these hair cells will bend over. And the bending of those hair cells is what creates sound transmission back into the brain. If the sound is not strong enough, do those hair cells bend? No. So do you hear anything if those hair cells don't bend? Not a thing. Yeah. So if somebody's whispering and it's below your threshold for hearing, then that means that those hair cells do not get bent and there is no transmission of sound into the brain. So way back when we studied threshold, we said that was the point at which we were going to create an action potential no matter what. So same thing here with your ear. If you're going to hear anything, there has to be a strong enough push of fluid against those hair cells to bend them over. That creates an action potential if you reach threshold that then is transmitted by way of your vestibulocochlear nerve. So no bending of hair cells means there's no hearing that's going to be received by your brain. So plain and simple, that's how that works. People who work around a very loud environment, if you work on a helicopter pad, you know, if you work in an airport where there's jet engines, if you work around loud concerts where there's loud music, construction sites, any of those locations that have really loud sounds, if a person does not wear hearing protection, then what happens to your hair cells? They can die. Exactly. So we can permanently damage those hair cells. They will no longer transmit sounds into the brain. And unfortunately, hearing aids have no benefit for a person who's had cochlear damage. That requires a cochlear implant that bypasses those damaged hair cells. So we'll talk a little bit more about that form of deafness in just a little bit. Okay, so talked about the cochlea. Any questions so far on inner ear? Let's talk about the very bottom of your page. There's something called a vestibule. So to look at this inner ear structure, you'll notice a couple of things. You'll notice a snail-like cochlea. That's our hearing organ. You'll notice these three little canals. There's one at the top, there's one that loops out at the side, and there's one coming straight out at us. Those are called semicircular canals. And then there's a connecting piece between those canals and the cochlea. It's kind of like a walkway. That walkway is called the vestibule. And inside the vestibule, we have other types of receptors. It is their job to detect a sense of equilibrium and balance. Okay? And so that balance is what we think of as being upright, not able to, you know, not stumbling, not being drunk or inebriated with our hearing, not with vertigo, that kind of thing. And also a spatial orientation, which is part of equilibrium. So inside that vestibule, we also have little tiny hair cells. In this picture, here they are sticking up right here. And those hair cells are connected to neurons that transmit information back once again to that vestibulocochlear nerve. Now, sitting on top of these hair cells is not a thin runny fluid, but rather a thick gel. And you'll notice it says gelatinous layer, and on top are some little teeny tiny rocks called otoliths. This is fascinating. You know, people always throw insults. They say, you got rocks in your head. Why, yes, we do. We have teeny tiny otoliths in the vestibule. And when you move your head about, those otoliths will slide and make that gelatinous layer move. And if you do that, what happens to your hair cells down below? They move, yeah. So when you're going back and forth with your head, especially on a boat or in a car, you get seasick, right? So your eye and your ear actually relay this information to your midbrain. So those auditory and visual reflexes are routed through there, and we expect to have the same sensation. If the boat's riding up and down waves, you know, your head is moving with that, and your eye should be as well. But there's a lag there, and of course, if you're not looking at the horizon, you start to get a sense of seasickness because your ear sensations in this area and your eye are not giving the same information to your midbrain. So there comes this sense of nausea from having the two disagree. So, awful feeling, yeah. A very helpless feeling. So cool stuff there. Those otoliths are teeny tiny little calcium carbonate rocks. Here they are. They look like little tiny pieces of chalk. And unfortunately, if they get misplaced inside your ear, for instance, if they slide into some other portion of your ear, they give you a sense of motion all the time. So people who have vertigo may be dizzy or just standing there and feeling sick to their stomach because they feel motion, in fact, when they're not moving. Those otoliths have slid away from the vestibule and into some other portion of the ear. For those of you considering physical therapy as a potential career path, that is something physical therapists help with. They can take someone's head and reposition over and over to get those otoliths to slide back into the proper location. And if they're successful, they can prevent someone from having vertigo from those otoliths escaping into another portion of the ear. So, yeah, really important little tiny, tiny stones there inside the ear. Okay. So, any questions so far about this page, page 130? Okay. All right, so let's talk about those semicircular canals. In this picture, you kind of get a better view of them. There are three little tiny canals inside your ear. Now, let me give you perspective for where we're sitting. We are so far inside the head that these semicircular canals poke into your temporal bone. So it'd be rather difficult to reach them because we are talking about portions of your ear embedded in temporal bone. So you'll notice at the top of your page that this particular portion of your inner ear functions in rotational movement. Probably one of the best examples I can give you is riding on a merry-go-round at a playground. You're spun around and around in a circle, and if they spin you long enough on that merry-go-round, how do you feel when you get off the merry-go-round? You're still going round and round, right? So you stand there for a few minutes, you're letting your head come back to rest. So what is happening to the fluid inside those canals? Still moving, yep. So every time you spin in a circle, whether it's a merry-go-round, dancing, whatever you may be on, roller coasters or rides, the fluid inside those semicircular canals is going to move. And the fluid movement is what creates a sense of rotational movement. So unfortunately, it does take a moment for that fluid to come to a stop, and until it does, you do feel a sense of rotation. Spinning around in circles, yeah. And same thing here, you can get vertigo. If there's fluids, if there's pressure creating fluid movement, you can also get a sense of vertigo from those semicircular canals. So if you've got, say, an ear, nose infection, sinus infection, or ear infection, it can push back into those locations too. Okay, so let's talk about equilibrium and balance down halfway of your page. Static equilibrium is when your head is technically not moving, meaning you're not moving your head. So, like I said, if you're riding a boat, riding a car, you're not technically moving your head. Your head is static in space. But if you're in motion, we call that dynamic equilibrium. So only when you change the position of the hair cells do we transmit information to your brain by way of your vestibulocochlear nerve. And technically, the semicircular canals deal with rotational movement, while the vestibule deals with balance and static head position. Okay, so just to repeat here, we have not only the sense of hearing detected by the inner ear's cochlea, we also have a sense of balance and equilibrium detected by the semicircular canals and that vestibule. So we actually take care of two senses here.
Balance.
Both are conducted by the inner ear.
So direction of movement, semicircular canals, that's balance and equilibrium.
The semicircular canals are more for rotational movement, such as spinning in a circle like on a merry-go-round. The vestibule is more for static movement, static, which is staying still, and equilibrium, which is balance. But they're not going to work independent of each other. They're going to work together to give you a sense of where your head is in space. At the bottom of the page, I gave you a little bit of information on sound terminology. I wouldn't worry too much with this. I just wanted to introduce it to you in case you've never had a physical science or physics course. We're going to talk about how loud sounds are or how high pitched they are, and that is all relative to sound waves. So I just want to give you an idea of where we're getting those terms from using images there on the bottom of your page. So the difference between pitch and loudness has to do with how we examine the sound waves that we're listening to. So let me take you over to page 132. When we're talking about the pitch of a sound, we're talking about if it's high pitched and squeaky like a mouse, or if it's low pitch and rumbling like thunder. Okay? And so when we're looking at pitch, we are looking at the frequency of the wavelength. You'll notice that we're looking at the distance between the two peaks there to give us how high-pitched or how low-pitched the noise is. We measure this pitch in hertz, which is a measurement specifically referenced for those kinds of noises. That is different, though, from how we measure loudness, which is measured in decibels. So the loudness that we hear has to do with the height of those waves. The taller the waves, the higher the amplitude of those waves, and the louder a sound is going to be. Okay, so the intensity of the sound directly relates back to the height of the wave, which is known as its amplitude, and that makes a really loud sound. So what are some really loud sounds that could damage your ears? Loud music, sure. Gunshot. Even fireworks that are close by. Okay, construction zones where there's a lot of loud noise. Airplanes, engines, things of that sort. So when we're thinking about the loudness of a sound, we're thinking about the height of those waves. The higher the wave, the louder the sound is going to be. So, thanks. Anybody else need to sign in for today? And I'll check you off. Okay, so pitch is the distance between the waves, how frequently they come, but the loudness is the height of those waves. Alright, so let's talk about the pathway of sound into the ear. We're going to first talk about your collection devices, which are the pinna or auricle. That's the portion of the ear that we can see. This collects sound waves and sends it down into a canal known as the external auditory meatus or external auditory canal. The very first portion of your ear to vibrate with sound waves is your what? Tympanic membrane, good. So the other name for your tympanic membrane is?
Eardrum.
All right. So the eardrum vibrates with sound, and that vibrates against three little tiny ear bones known as ossicles. What is the first one to vibrate?
Malleus,
good. The second one to vibrate? Incus, good. And the last one? Stapes or stapes, good. So we've got malleus, incus, and stapes or stapes. It is critical for these little ear bones to vibrate because they amplify or make louder the sounds that we hear.
What's the name of the ear bone?
Ossicles. Yeah, teeny. They're the tiniest little bones we've got.
So eardrums, ossicles, and malleus, incus.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's the floor.
Yeah, from eardrum to malleus, incus, stapes. So that's the order that they vibrate in. So let's take a look at this picture. Here's the eardrum once again. There's malleus, there's incus, and there's the stirrup or stapes. It vibrates against an oval window that sits beneath the stirrup. Right there it is. And that oval window is vibrating against a fluid-filled inner ear. So we've got semicircular canals, vestibule, and cochlea. Which of those three is going to detect the sound waves? Cochlea, yeah. So the cochlea has hair cells inside. When the sound waves are strong enough, those hair cells bend, and the bending of those hair cells creates an action potential. An action potential is a nerve impulse that is now transmitted by way of this nerve. That's cranial nerve number 8. We're now heading back by way of the vestibulocochlear nerve into the brain. So, if we're talking about the right ear, into which portion of your brain are we going with sound information?
Left,
yeah, so the left hemisphere. Which lobe picks up on that information?
Temporal,
good. We pass through a relay station in the middle called? Thalamus, yes, we pass through the thalamus. So, of course, this kind of links us back in where we were with that brain information earlier on. All right, so from the cochlea to the vestibulocochlear nerve to the temporal lobe on the opposite hemisphere of the brain. All right, so that's basically the pathway of sound into the brain. That is something you'll want to count on for being a multiple choice setup on the final exam. Be sure you got your blanks there. Under step 2, you've got malleus is number 4, incus is number 5. And stapes or stapes is number 6. OK, Okay, so let's do this one more time from the top. Sound waves are collected by the external ear structure known as what? Auricle, good. Auricle or pinna. That is sent down a canal into the temporal bone known as? Good, external auditory meatus. The next structure to vibrate is your eardrum, otherwise known as? Tympanic membrane, good. From there, we have three little ear bones that vibrate. Malleus, then, and finally, stapes. And stapes vibrates against a window. Which one? Oval window, good. So in this picture, you can see it a little easier. Oval window sits right up underneath the stapes. So, you know, if you think about how a bass drum works, when somebody pounds their foot on the bass drum pedal, that head vibrates against a drum, and that's what that stapes is doing. Every time sound waves hit it, it vibrates and pushes against that oval window. So the oval window transmits the information to our snail-shaped cochlea, and there's going to be hair cells. From that point forward, where do we go next? Yeah, which cranial nerve? Good, vestibulocochlear nerve. Good, that's number 8. So, of course, that takes the sound back into the brain on the opposite hemisphere. So don't forget to fill in that blank there as well. Cranial nerve 8 is vestibulocochlear nerve. It is on the final, yeah. And I'll give you, like, pathways to pick from, so you'll just want to know the correct order of things.
Okay.
Because
there's no written discussion.
No, there's no written, no essay, yeah.
So it's multiple choice, and we have to know the correct.
Pick the correct pathway, yeah. So we talked a little bit about deafness earlier on. I do want to tie this up by talking about two types of deafness near the bottom of your page. One there is called conduction deafness, and this has to do when the ossicles fuse and are unable to magnify or amplify the sound waves coming into the brain. So like I was mentioning earlier, if a person has earwax buildup, for instance, that earwax can impede the sound waves from traveling into that inner portion of your brain, or your ear rather, and of course, if those ossicles can't vibrate and amplify the sound, then they're not loud enough for us to hear. The good news is that hearing aids can help a person with conduction deafness by doing what those ossicles should have been doing in the first place, which is to amplify the sound waves. So, you know, hearing aids are kind of like just an amplifier for sound coming into the ear. Hearing aids, however, are not a good solution for someone with sensory neural deafness. You'll notice in that case, what part of the ear is damaged? Cochlea, yeah. So in that case, unfortunately, a cochlear implant would be the workaround process. That would then send sound waves into the brain. So cochlear implants are going to be required for someone who has sensory neural deafness. Imagine the scenario where a person has both disorders. You know, somebody who has, say, ear bones fuse, and who has nerve damage. So if you've got that scenario, hearing aids still don't work because you've got damage to those hair cells inside the cochlea. So unfortunately, if you've got any form of nerve damage to the ear, then it becomes very difficult to use hearing aids because they're just not going to amplify the sound loud enough. I did mention tinnitus. That is oftentimes problems with those ossicle bones. If they're vibrating and there's not actually any sound to transmit, then that sound of ringing or buzzing is going to come across in your brain. So tinnitus often is the fault of those ossicle bones. All right, so that is it. But I do want to draw your attention. If you'll flip the page with me. I know life is plenty full over the next week. There are about 15 questions on the bottom of page 133. And those 15 questions will help make sure that you've got yourself covered for the final exam. I do recommend that you look through those. Okay? And so you've got 7 on the eye and 8 there on the ear. So, in case you don't see it on the list there, you'll need to know the pathway of vision into the eye and back into the brain. It is a multiple choice setup. It is listed there as number 3 under the eye. And likewise, under the ear, number 3 traces the sound waves into the brain. So for number 3, I want to make sure that you're comfortable with that sound wave or vision pathway. All right, so any questions on those 15 questions or anything from the ear? All right, so we're done. That's it, you finished the course. At this point, if you have any questions for the final, I'll be happy to entertain those. If you don't have questions and want to leave, I'll wait for those to clear out, and those left behind, we can do questions. Okay, question on chemistry. Jenny, do you have a question?
No, I just don't want to miss anything.
Okay. Okay.
Well, my question was basically, I need a better understanding with how certain stuff turns into, with the chemistry part, proteins and what sugars. I didn't get that.
Okay, let's go back to that.
I'm not even sure what to point it out in the book because I just didn't understand it.
That is probably chapter 2. Let's go back to organic compounds. Which is page?
I got like all the cations, anions. I understand that, but when it came to like, if you got phosphate, you got this, what does it make me?
Okay, that is probably page, let's start with 19. Okay, so to begin with, background information about all the organic compounds. They typically have long chains of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, but we'll talk about some that have specifically nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur. And we'll talk about, is that kind of where your sticky point is?
Yeah, because I get everything up until about 15 minutes.
You got building reactions and breakdown reactions? That's 18.
That's
right. 18.
Yep.
Okay. So when you are, let's say you're eating lunch, and when you eat lunch, you actually take all those particles of food and you break them down. And that breakdown process is catabolism. And it breaks down the fats, the proteins, the carbs into their building blocks, which we're going to go through. And then you can take and reassemble those building blocks through a building reaction that we call anabolism. And so anabolic reactions are building reactions. I think of anabolic steroids because they bulk up a person, and anabolism just builds new molecules. So anabolism is building, catabolism is breakdown. In terms of the types of groups here, carbs have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. That is pretty much it. Long chains of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, and they're going to be giving us quickest levels of energy. Okay, and notice in this one here, lots of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens. Excuse me. Thank you. The typical ratio here is twice the hydrogens as carbons and oxygens. So if you were to count all these carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens and boil it down to the lowest common denominator, you would have twice the hydrogens as you have carbons and oxygens. And the word carbohydrate technically means carbon, and then hydrate is water. So that's where the word comes from, carbohydrate. So, you know, you can have multiples of this. You can have C6, H12O6, and that still, if you take it down to its lowest common denominator, is twice the hydrogens as carbons and oxygens. So that's what you got in the sugar category, is building blocks called monosaccharides, like glucose. It's a real common one. And we build our more complex sugars from these basic building blocks. Mostly we're looking at between 3 and 7 carbon atoms for a simple sugar, double that for a disaccharide, and many, many of those linked together to make a polysaccharide.
So with glucose, fructose, and galactose, how would I know the difference being that they have the same formula?
They're going to have a different structure, and that's why they're considered isomers. They're all C6H12O6.
When you ask us to identify?
We didn't talk about that specifically. I mean, I might say to you glucose, fructose, galactose have the same number of atoms. They have different structures.
They are isomers.
That's exactly right.
And then when you say, I have glucose, fructose, galactose, are these a monosaccharide, disaccharide, poly?
Yes.
Like
yes, sure. We'll ask if they're mono, di, or poly.
Well, I always get the question wrong that says,
same conversation, yes. So let's do this one. If I'm talking about dehydration synthesis, it's just another name for anabolic reaction. So when you see dehydration synthesis or anabolism, I automatically say, oh, that's a building reaction. And so if I say I'm dehydration synthesis with, say, glucose and glucose, what do I make? Well, in this case, I make maltose. Or if I take glucose and fructose together, I make sucrose. So for some of these, you'll need to know the building blocks. Sucrose and maltose are two that you'll want to know the building blocks for. But what I'm typically doing is I'm giving you the building blocks when I ask you that question, and I'm just asking you what we build with it.
And what page is that on?
The dehydration synthesis by itself is 18. The sucrose maltose info is 19. And then the amino acids, like you mentioned in your test, that comes over from page 22. Well, then the nucleic acids are going to be over on 24. So if I say I'm doing dehydration synthesis and I'm using, or I could say the dehydration synthesis of nucleotides makes, you have three choices there. You could say it makes DNA, RNA, or ATP. Or if I say to you, I'm doing dehydration synthesis of fatty acids and glycerols, then you say I am working with, I'm making fats.
So dehydration synthesis just means I'm building?
I'm building.
Okay.
And if I flip the question and say we have a catabolic reaction or a hydrolysis reaction of a protein, then you'd say, oh, breakdown. Yeah, so what is the... If I break down proteins, I make their building blocks, which are amino acids.
So breakdown...
We wouldn't go that next step below, but I would say the breakdown of a protein makes amino acids.
The building of amino acids makes proteins?
Yeah, back and forth. You can do it this way. Like amino acids make proteins, and that's called anabolism or dehydration synthesis. Or if you're coming this way, then we're doing hydrolysis, yeah.
Catabolism,
exactly. And you could do that with every organic compound. You could set it up with like carbs and monosaccharides. You could set it up with fatty acids and glycerols and lipids. And you could do nucleic acids and nucleotides the same way. That's kind of, I think, that is that where your sticking point is?
Yeah, well, I'm still, I'm just probably going to have to go listen to the thing over again.
I think if you can get stuck, the building block and the category, like monosaccharides are the building block for carbs, then you'll have this relationship down pat.
Yeah, that's what I need to know.
Okay.
So monosaccharides are the building blocks for carbs.
Fatty acids and glycerol are the building blocks for lipids. And they're the top line of each page.
Okay.
Like lipids, let's see. Yeah, lipids on page 20, at the very top, it should say building blocks, fatty acid and glycerol. And then flip over to 22 with me, and then you'll see proteins. Their building blocks are amino acids. And then one more, we've got nucleic acids, and their building blocks is a nucleotide.
And then where would I find the different types of amino acids? Is it on this same page?
Yeah, but you don't have to know them. All you have to know is that an amino acid is the building block for the protein.
That's probably why I keep getting stuff.
Yeah, there's 20 and you don't have
the rest.
Yeah, you don't have to know them.
Is that more like 2 or 11 or you just don't have to know that?
You just don't have to know them. We talk about it when we talk about nutrition.
Okay.
But that's it. But we don't even learn them. We don't memorize them then.
Okay.
They're weird names like leucine and cysteine and
okay.
Tryptophan and stuff like that.
Okay. So all I would have to know is if you put on your test that protein is being broken down or build up, it would turn to a amino acid.
Correct.
And then if it was a lipid being broken down or build up, I would have to know that this is going to turn to a fatty acid and glycerol.
That's right.
Okay.
And then page 19 is the carbohydrates.
Yeah, 19 is your carbs with the monosaccharide.
Then if you break down a carbohydrate, you have glucose, glucose, or galactose.
Right. Monosaccharide covers it, yeah. And elsewhere I may say, select the monosaccharide from the list, and then you know it's one of those three.
How about when you have, this is just random, I don't know, you see you have like glucose plus and a certain arrow, that point somewhere.
I'm checking to see if you recognize a dehydration synthesis reaction, and there's two clues. There's normally two clues. One, in this one, glucose is a monosaccharide. Maltose is a disaccharide, so knowing that will say, we're building. But the second clue is the location of water. When you're building, water is always a product.
That's what I look at.
Oh.
That's what I look at. It's so much easier.
So if water is on the ending part of mm-hmm. arrow, then that would be anabolism?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And if water is a reactant, you are breaking down.
So if water is on the front side,
correct. Yep. So water would be here if you have hydrolysis.
Can you give me an example of one that shows water at the front?
I don't know if I have one up here, but I can write one on the board for you. You can just take this one and flip-flop it. You can take sucrose and water. That's your disaccharide. And that is going to give you glucose and fructose.
But it'll always have water in it?
It'll always have water, yep.
Oh, that might be the easiest way to do it. If the water is the main thing, then I can get it. Because I just used to look at it like I'm confused. I'm confused. So.
Yeah, the water is going to give you a huge clue.
When you're taking the water out, it's dehydration.
Right.
Synthesis. You're taking water out. If you're adding water to it, that's hydrolysis.
That's right. Yeah, because dehydration means to remove water. Exactly right.
Okay, so that's sucrose water.
That's putting it in.
So that would be the hydrolysis?
Yeah. That's a good topic to go back over. That's a commonly missed thing. Which is weird, but yeah.
Yeah, because I'm like, okay, well, wait a minute, that doesn't even make sense, but I just overthink, so I just gotta.
Sometimes it's just easier to memorize it straight out.
Yeah, I'm not doing it.
And don't forget, if you're confused, look and see what you got, because disaccharides breaking down into monos is another confirmation that reassures you that, yeah, this is a breakdown reaction. I can twist myself backwards if I've got something memorized. So.
Yeah,
those dishes soak and I'll pause this recording. Okay, so we're looking at spinal cord cross section. We're just going to do a run through. All right, so let's see. Dorsal root carries sensory or motor?
Sensory,
good. Let's see. Let's do this one because it doesn't have like labels on it. The dorsal horn of gray matter, okay, back here at the back. Sensory neurons, interneurons, or motor neurons?
Interneurons,
good. The ventral root carries what kind of information?
Motor,
good. This spinal nerve here is sensory, motor, or mixed?
Mixed,
good. The lateral horn of gray matter carries what kind of neuron?
Somatic.
Is it motor or sensory?
Sensory.
Yeah, that is motor. Okay, that's motor.
Say it again now. Go back and say it again.
The lateral horns of the gray matter, right here and right here.
Oh, the lateral horns. I knew that.
Yeah, has motor, and is it autonomic or somatic?
Autonomic.
Yeah.
See?
Those are two easy ones to get confused. So the ventral horn or anterior horn is.
Yeah, because somatic is skeletal.
Yes,
somatic.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then we've got columns of white matter. We've got a column back here that is called what?
The dorsal column.
Dorsal column, good. And on each side we have. Good. And in the front?
Ventral
columns. Good. And in those columns, we have tracts. If they take information to the brain, they're called?
Ascending.
And if you're talking about pain and temperature specifically, what type of ascending tract is that?
The
spinothalamic. That's right. And then if you're talking about, say, equilibrium or balance, where do we take that information? Cerebellum. Yeah, that's right. Okay, and then we've got descending tracts that come back down through the spinal cords, white matter, and that descending information is sensory or motor?
Motor,
that's right. So where do we house voluntary movement of skeletal muscles within the spinal cord?
In the visceral.
Voluntary movement of skeletal muscles? Ventral horn, yeah. And where do we house involuntary movement of smooth muscle?
Lateral
horn, good. And contralateral control involves this bridge in the middle known as?
Great
commissure. And that hole in the middle transports fluids known as?
Cerebrospinal
fluid, good. We have two horns devoted to motor control in the gray matter. What are they?
Ventral
and lateral, good. Which horn controls voluntary skeletal muscles?
Ventral,
good. And what kind of muscle control is the lateral horn?
Smooth muscle,
good. Involuntary control of smooth muscles, good. That's the only sticky point. Yeah.
Do we have time to look at the brain?
Yeah, we have time to look at the brain. We got, what, about 10 minutes?
That was where I missed.
Let's get that picture pulled back up. We'll hit that one. Talking about like brain parts and brain functions.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Let's do that one. Okay. So we talk about the cerebrum with four lobes. Which lobe houses the sense of vision?
Occipital,
good. Which specific portion of the visual areas receives the information first?
Association.
Primary, right. And now what does the association area do?
Interprets,
good. So if we talk about the visual interpretation area, it makes sense of what you see.
So is the cortex first, then the visual, then association?
Yeah, it'll say primary cortex, and then it will say association area. So whatever the sense is, you go primary first and then association. Let's see. If you're talking about the primary somatic sensory cortex, where is that one located? Primary somatic sensory. Parietal, good. And what is that little groove or that raised hill of tissue? Post-central gyrus, yeah. So when you put your hand in your pocket and you feel something, simply the sense of feeling whatever's in there is primary somatic sensory cortex. When you feel that and you say, oh, those are some quarters and dimes and nickels, that association area sits further back, but still in the parietal lobe.
Do you know offhand what page that is?
111 or 113 sounds familiar. 113. But you don't know what they are yet.
Yeah, you just
feel something. Yeah, and then the association area allows you to interpret that. Oh, okay, now I know what I've got.
And 115 is that picture that we drew where she has right all over it and labeled everything? That's 115.
Yeah. At a certain point, that was the day we were supposed to have that storm. We had to get out.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Did you have your student model?
So let's talk about personality. Which lobe houses personality?
Frontal,
good. Which lobe houses, let's say, hearing?
Temporal,
good. What specific lobe houses voluntary motor control? Frontal, good. And the name of the ridge of tissue that houses the primary motor cortex?
Precentral gyrus.
Yeah, precentral gyrus, good. And the groove that separates pre and postcentral gyrus is known as?
Sulcus.
Central sulcus, good. Let's say, hearing is found in which lobe?
Temporal lobe.
Along with what other sense?
Smell.
Good. And taste and sense of feeling are in which lobe?
The left hemisphere. Parietal lobe.
Parietal lobe, yeah. Speaking of left hemisphere, what specific function is housed only in the left hemisphere for most people?
Math and all of that.
You're right, math is, and also speech for most of us. Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember we had a question like that. You asked us about math and science.
Yeah, and spatial orientation is right hemisphere. Yeah. How about the internal parts like cerebellum, brainstem, are you okay with that, or is this more the sticking point?
You can go with that.
Okay.
That's what you got to have, Wesley.
So let's see, the pons is a main location for what function?
Pons is breathing.
Breathing, good. Where do we house a coordination of balance and equilibrium with our skeletal muscles?
The cerebellum.
Good. Good. There are four centers, vomiting, heart rate, blood pressure. They are housed.
Hypothalamus.
Medulla oblongata. Good. Let's see. We're talking about a relay center for incoming sensory information.
Thalamus.
Good. How about homeostasis, hunger, thirst, body temperature control?
Hypothalamus.
So
if it says vomiting is in the midbrain.
Vomiting is actually medulla.
Okay.
Yeah. And two places in the brain that have no blood-brain barrier.
Medulla oblongata and hypothalamus.
Yeah, medulla and hypothalamus, good. And the control for, well, hypothalamus is really the control for endocrine, but the pituitary also is a big player in that. So that's something we'll talk about in 211. Let's see, reflex control of auditory and visual information is from this area here. And it's hard to see with that stuff in the way. It's midbrain.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's midbrain, pons, and medulla.
Yeah, midbrain is usually right in here, and then your right pons, and then medulla.
And then
if you keep
spine.
Going. Yep, you're at the spinal cord, yeah. That's good. You gotta have a trick to keep it straight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, I know it now when I was first learning. That's
and I, do you have any like old videos from when you taught lab on the brain?
I don't think so. I've got videos of lecture on YouTube, but not lab videos.
There's a teacher on YouTube. It's called Teach Me AMD. She goes through, she, you know how when we did muscles in lab and we had the models, her models match our models.
Oh, super.
And she goes through everything.
Do you know what I mean?
And if you go through, she goes through them several times. And she gives you certain things to be able to read.
Do you remember her name?
Teach Me AMD.
I think I probably follow her because I know that, okay, I think that's probably her. But do you know her name?
It's just teach me.
Okay.
On YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
All right. Well, yeah, because I'm trying.